Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today, I have Phil Hack. Phil is formerly Microsoft, now working on GitHub for Windows. Looking forward to talking with him both about the product and about the structure at GitHub, and also John Galloway.
It sounded like you were saying you want to talk to Phil about all those things, and also about John Galloway.
Dangling antecedents. Yes, I wanted to talk about Phil about John Galloway.
I didn't want you talking about John Galloway at all. I have lots of. John and I used to work together a long time ago.
Long ago, yep.
Technically, we were both at Microsoft at the same time. But no, he was the first hire at a company that a friend of mine and I started.
Phil rescued me from a very boring financial company. So, yeah. Thanks, Phil.
Good job. Yeah, I didn't realize you guys went back so far. So what year was that?
2005 or 2007, somewhere around there.
Somewhere around there, yeah. It was a good while ago.
You guys are so young that sounds like a long time ago. So, Phil, you're working on GitHub for Windows, and I have lots of questions about GitHub for Windows, but I saw a presentation by one of the founders of GitHub at which he talked about not having managers and running things on the basis of how open source worked. That is to say, people were motivated to work on things, so they worked on them, and if they were motivated to work on something else, they worked on that. And there were no formal vacations, and it was basically, I won't say anarchy, but it was very open. Is that how things are there?
Yes, it is. I mean, in some ways, it is slightly anarchic in that there's no central authority, so to speak. But it's not anarchy in the sense of chaos. You know, anarchy and chaos are actually kind of two different things. But it definitely, it's... A lot of people are skeptical when they hear it. They don't believe it works, or they believe that there's this subtle, hidden power structure. And for the most part, it does work, for us at least. And, we're not the only company to do this. You've probably heard of Valve, the makers of Half-Life. So they have a similar structure, no managers, or no hierarchy. There are definitely, and one important point, there are definitely people who are leaders. But there's no there's no hierarchy, there's no formal, yeah, exactly, no management. Like, you're a leader because people want to follow you. One of the more famous companies that has this model is Gore and Associates, the makers of Gore-Tex. So they've scaled this out to about 8,000 employees, and there's a great article that they wrote where they said something along the lines of, if you call a meeting and nobody shows up, then you're not a leader.
That's great. So it's interesting because I was going to ask you about size, because at the presentation that I saw, someone asked, well, how does this scale to a really large company? And I love the answer, which was, I have no idea. it was great. So how many people are we talking about?
Around 140 people. So the thing is, we know that the model can scale because it has scaled to at least to 8,000 with Gordon Associates. But you know, in the sense of we don't know is that we haven't done it yet. And so we have a lot to learn from their experiences as well as, you know, Valve's experiences, because I think Valve's like around 400 employees. So there are companies out there that are sort of models for us to look at. And hopefully if we're very careful, you know, we can continue to scale this out. Now, in that talk, he kind of mentioned that he models it after the open source community, right? And so, you know, you kind of ask, well, how does the open source community scale, right? That's a pretty large community you're talking about, and there's no, like, central leader, you know, who is the CEO of the open source community, right? So we know that, you know, like a lot of times we're so embedded in this like industrial revolutionary hierarchical model that we don't realize that that's not the only possible way to organize people's efforts.
Yes, but the key question is, do you have stock ranking once a year?
Oh, man.
We do not.
You know, it's funny, Phil, that you mentioned that with open source, because I really think about that as well. I mean, also as a remote employee, and the whole, like a lot of the kind of traditional structures don't really apply with that also. You know, and really like the focus on like with open source and then with kind of more, different organizational models is all focus on productivity rather than position. And so it's not so much that, you know, well, this person is managing this person and, you know, you go to work and you go to meetings all day and you come home tired from meetings and it's been a full day, but it's like, well, what do you actually get done? You know, and that's definitely like, so like an open source project with, you know, a bunch of people on discussion, you know, list, but not actually shipping any code. Well, that's not really an effective open source project either.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I don't want to talk bad about anyone previously or burn any bridges, but I'll just say in a former employer that I used to work at, you know, there were many cases you'd be in a meeting and you would look before you were in the meeting, you look at the title of people and that tells you who to pay attention to and who to listen to, because those were the ones you had to convince. Or be in a meeting where your entire team has done all this research and just knows that this particular plan of attack is the right plan of attack, only to have someone who isn't as tied to the community or whatever you're working on say, well, I don't know, that doesn't jive with me, so I want you to continue, you know, like spinning in circles trying to convince me, rather than, you know, saying, well, let's explicitly have a sense of trust for, you know, my reports and just go do it and then we'll see, right? Like, if you've done all this research, you should do it. And I as one of the things that I find troublesome with sort of, hierarchy that's given by title is that these, you know, a person with a title often has that because they've been there a long time. I mean, certainly they probably have earned it to some degree as well. But the whole point of hiring people, especially in a creative industry like programming, is that you want to hire the best people possible, people ideally who are better than you at what they do. And so if you can't trust them to make those kind of decisions after they've done the research, then you've become a bottleneck. And I think that's often sort of the big problem with hierarchical systems. Now, not to say that every company that has a hierarchy has managers that do this, right? I mean, sometimes managers are very good at seeing themselves as almost like point guards. You know, they're there to distribute the ball. They're there to remove obstacles for their employees. But what often happens is that when you have this position of seniority, like if something doesn't jive with the way you think things are, you leverage your seniority in ways that a marketplace of ideas wouldn't allow.
Well, let's get a little bit more concrete. Talk to me about how people get hired into a system without managers and how you handle, you should forgive the expression, accountability.
Good question. So we do have teams within GitHub. So, for example, I work on a team that I call the Windows team. We're focused on GitHub for Windows and various products and stuff that targets the Windows community at large. And so when we decide that we need another person to join us, you know, we kind of vet it with other people within the organization. We create an internal job posting, and then we talk it over with people. And in this case, the founders often get involved with the actual hiring, you know, with the salary negotiation. excuse me. So once we have sort of a consensus that we need a person, you know, we'll do the interviewing. We'll get several people outside of our team to interview a person. And if they're all a thumbs up, then, you know, one of the founders will do the salary negotiation, that sort of thing.
So people do make different salaries depending on what they negotiate.
I have no idea, to be honest.
Because at least one of the companies that I heard about like this, there were different stock options depending on how long you'd been there, but everybody from the top to the bottom made, well, there was no top and no bottom, but everybody across the board made the same salary. But it's interesting that you don't even know. So clearly that's not a major concern of yours.
Making less than what I was making at Microsoft at the time in total salary, but I didn't care because I was a lot happier. I felt like I had autonomy, purpose, and a room to gain mastery, right? Like the three things that Dan Pink says you look for in a good job, in a good situation. Autonomy,
give me those again.
Mastery,
autonomy,
and purpose. If you watch, there's a really great talk by Dan Pink about what the surprising truth of what really motivates us. And I've mentioned it, you know, a few times because it just, after I watched that, it really struck me. And it sort of is what drew me to GitHub, because I realized that in the talk, he shows, cites all these studies that show, like, once, you know, you make a certain amount, let's say it's around, in the U.S., around $70,000 a year, more money doesn't necessarily equate to more happiness. And it turns out that what people really want, you know, from a job is those things that I mentioned, right? They want to be somewhat in control of their destiny, you know, have autonomy. They want to be able to get better at what they do, you know, be able to master their skills. And then they want to feel like that what they do has some amount of purpose. And so, like, if you're in a culture that is stifling you with, like, tons of meetings, for example, then sometimes that can feel like it saps away at your autonomy because you're not in control of your own time. You're spending all your time in meetings rather than, as John pointed out earlier, being actually productive. And so that's like one of the things that in this talk you probably saw, he mentioned that there's no meetings at GitHub. We don't have, we generally don't do things through meetings. We do things through like chat rooms or pull requests or various other means of communication, but we don't have the, okay, everybody, let's get in a room and waste everyone's time for an hour.
And are you co-located or are you all spread out?
We're spread out. We're about over 60% remote. So I work out of my home in I'm still up here in the Bellevue, Washington area, near like 2 miles from Microsoft. But the 40% of the employees work in San Francisco. That's where the headquarters are. But like I said, we have a guy in Greece, people in Australia, Spain, all over the U.S. So we're pretty spread about.
John, what do you think? Should we apply for
this? Well, they turned me down twice, so I don't know. No, I'm kidding.
I see. It is a radical challenge to how you think about an organization, a software development organization, to have no management structure and to have leadership by demonstrated ability and people's willingness to go along with what they're suggesting. I mean, that certainly turns things, the traditional approach, on its head. It's very appealing, and it's fascinating to know it's working.
It depends on what your job role is in a company, but I've found that there are parts of that can apply to pretty much anywhere. Like, for instance, I mean, right now I'm working in evangelism, but I mean, obviously, like, a lot of what I do, I'm remote, and a lot of what, you know, like, you establish trust with your boss, and your boss definitely is like, you know, they write your review and they make sure that you're doing the, you know, focusing on the goals that they have for you. But at least in what I'm doing, I'm not in a whole bunch of kind of meetings like that. I've even found, like, long ago I was in the military. I was a junior officer on a submarine, and it's true there. I mean, that's about as organizationally bound as you can get. But I found that really the most effective work that I did was in getting the team, like, excited about what we were working on and getting them to actually, like, own and buy into our projects, even when they were kind of crappy projects or they had to work on the weekend or stuff like that, rather than just saying, like, look, I'm in charge, do what I said, you know what I mean? I mean, and there's different, yeah, I don't know. But you know,
go ahead.
Well, I think one of the things that I found worked well there, especially in the military, was convincing the team that the right thing was their idea. I mean, not sneakily convincing them, but basically saying, like, you know, like, working with them, and they would arrive and own the right idea, and it would be kind of like, hey, we're doing this, rather than me like pushing something on them. And they would always, you know, usually given the right information, they would come up with the right thing to do. But they just had to feel like they owned it.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the nuclear submarine. So I think a lot of times, you know, one of the things when we talk about this model is we say, like, it is predicated on hiring good people. You need people who are kind of self-motivated and, you know, buy into the system and aren't, like, always looking at to take advantage of the system. But at the same time, I think what we're finding more and more is that when you present the system to more people, they buy into it because it makes sense to, like, it, you know, it empowers them. And it works in places that you wouldn't expect. You know, a lot of times in the Valve handbook, they talk about how this model works really great for creative industries. It's not the command and control model for the military, you know. But then I watched this talk recently, a TEDx talk, where there was this admiral who was being assigned to a different submarine that he, you know, didn't really know the full details of. It was a brand new one, and he didn't, you know, all the details. And, he initially started off, like, giving these orders, and some of these orders just didn't make sense. Like, you know, like, he's like, go back two-thirds, and there is no two-thirds setting. So they were just sitting there, and he's like, he asked the second-in-command, why didn't you tell me that there was no two-thirds setting? And he's like, well, you know, because you gave the order to do it.
Right. You know, they have just to briefly interrupt, but we had a term for that. It was called malicious compliance. And so if somebody was going to be a jerk and they were going to tell you what to do and it was really stupid, but they were forceful about it, okay, you get what you asked for. You know, and it was, after a while, you got to just see people and things would always go wrong for them. And after a while, you'd realize, well, it's because they're going about it in a very, you know, in the very wrong way, in the worst way.
Well, it's not only that, it's also that the soldiers are drilled to obey orders. That's how they're taught to, you know, that's what their entire core being as a soldier is, to obey orders. Mm-hmm. So what Admiral did that was very interesting is he decided that he was going to stop giving orders. He said, I'm going to give one more order, and that is to, you know, for you to do what you think is the best thing. And then he stopped giving orders. Like, he still conferred with people and, you know, offered his input. But, you know, he would ask them, well, what do you think we should do in this situation? And so over time, the crew started, you know, taking ownership of what they're doing. They felt empowered. And at the end of the tour, I forget the exact numbers, but he said that typically 3-5% and re-enlist, but he had something like 50% or 60% re-enlist. So it was like some unheard of like number, and he's able mm-hmm. to do it over and over again. So it's a TEDx talk, really great talk, but it kind of shows that like when you give people the power to make those decisions, they often rise to the occasion more so than you'd expect. And Spolsky actually wrote a really great article about this a long time ago, where he talked about the two theories of management, the X theory and the Y theory. And one is that people are inherently lazy and you have to, you know, whip them into shape and tell them what to do. Or people are inherently want to do good work, you just have to get rid of the obstacles for them to do that. And so I'm on the theory Y or whatever, whichever the second one is. I don't remember which one's X, which one's Y. But I definitely think that while there are lazy people out there, I don't think that's the inherent nature of people. Like, I think people want to do interesting, good stuff. They just want you to get out of the way.
Let's talk about what your day-to-day is like. You find yourself in your home office, and do you have a plan? Have you negotiated with other folks, or do you just say, this looks like it would be interesting to do, or this needs fixing? Or
I mean, I definitely have a focus. How do you figure out what's on your plate? Me and my team have a focus. We're working on GitHub for Windows. We're working on various other things. And we all, you know, have a general idea of what we're trying to accomplish. Let's say we're working on some major feature that, you know, we want to ship in a little while. And so then, you know, we have our GitHub repo. So we look at the issues and kind of figure out like, well, I'm going to work on this, you work on that. And we negotiate it within our campfire chat room. So pretty much every day I know more or less what I'm going to work on. And then some days I'll, you know, take a break and work on something different because I need, you know, just need to work on something different. sometimes I work on something that's completely unrelated to Windows. And then, you know, on Thursdays I go play soccer for a couple hours in the middle of the day. So I have a pretty relaxed schedule. My schedule is pretty, because I have kids and they go to school at certain times of the day, I have a pretty regimented schedule. Whereas I know a lot of the younger folks who don't have kids like work more erratic schedules, like, you know, late at night, early in the morning, that sort of thing. But I'm pretty much, I start around 9 or 8, I start around 8, and then I work till about 5, 5:30 when the family comes home. And then I might do a little bit of work at night if I'm in the mood.
And is your team co-reviewing each other's code, or is it pretty much independent, or how do you handle looking at each other's code?
So we do something called the GitHub flow. If you ever do a search for that, basically all of our feature work and bug fixes even are done in branches, and then we submit a pull request when it's ready, and then someone else, you know, we just try to get someone else from the team to look at it. So in general, we never commit directly to master, and we never merge code into master that hasn't been reviewed. There are, of course, exceptions to the rule when it's like text change or tiny fix that, you know, doesn't matter. But for the most part, everything gets a ship it squirrel. You know, like GitHub pull requests support emoji, and if you do colon ship it colon, there's a little squirrel there. That's our ship it squirrel. So we'll do that, or a thumbs up and that says, yeah, this looks good to me. Go ahead and merge it in.
Let me ask you a little bit more about GitHub for Windows itself. My experience of the product as a really naive user, someone who probably more so than many of your users is interested in getting things checked in and checked out and not a whole lot of interest in the internals necessarily, or even the advanced features. And my experience is that setting up a repository, cloning a repository, checking in, checking out are incredibly easy. But I live in dread of getting a merge problem or a conflict problem, and then having to sort through figuring out how to make that work. Is that also easy in GitHub for Windows, or is that something you're working on?
So that's definitely something we're working on.
What's the status of that?
Unfortunately, right now, if you run into a merge conflict, it's not very easy because we basically punt on it and say, you know, use the, you know, git command line to handle it. Now, that's in and of itself is not all that hard, but it does require a concept shift and learning how to use those tools. But that is definitely something that we want to improve and help people through, because we want GitHub for Windows usable by people who are not Git experts. People, you know, like you basically to say, you know, help walk you through how to resolve a merge conflict. So yeah, that's something that we're working on, but it's not there yet.
My merge conflict resolution is I call John and until he fixes it.
With other people? Is this stuff that you're working on
that,
with
Phil?
Other people then?
In some cases, it's stuff that, for example, John and I are working on a book together, and we're using GitHub for Windows for tracking both the book itself and some of the code. And then there's another project that I'm working on alone, and clearly I don't have merge conflicts with that one. That has not been a problem. You know you're in trouble if you have merge conflicts when you're the only person on the project.
It happens, but yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, and you know, it's funny because like there's a lot of fancy tools out there for handling merge conflicts, but I almost always just use Notepad. And you know, there are the markers in the file, and you just kind of delete the parts you don't want, keep the parts you do want, and then you run git add to add the file back to the index, and then you commit it. Now, I know that, like, for people who don't know what Git is, that this sounds complicated, but it's not that bad, but we definitely can and will make that a lot better.
So something attracted you to Git before you joined GitHub. Something attracted you to Git over, for example, Mercurial, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
And Subversion and any of the alternatives. So what was it about Git that really struck you as
well,
superior?
Initially, it's funny, because initially, I, like I went through everything, Source, Microsoft Visual Source Save. I did SourceGear Vault for a while. I did CVS, Subversion, Mercurial, and then finally Git. And I think initially what attracted me to Git was GitHub. I really enjoyed the experience of using GitHub. I think a lot of people feel that way. They sort of feel like they tolerate Git, but it's really GitHub that they like. But then one day I read this blog post about, it's just basically an explanation of how Git works under the hood, sort of the, and he just has these illustrative graphs. Oh, it's called Think Like a Git. It's just a really great blog post and or series of, it's a website, series of posts. And he presented a very visual look at what Git is doing and what it is. And when you learn it, you realize that Git is actually much simpler than people realize. It's just a set of these command line utilities over this addressable file system, where you have these nodes, this directed graph. And I know I'm not helping my cause here by saying it's real simple, but you can actually visualize this graph of all your commits and how things move around as you're changing branches, this and that. And in fact, I was inspired by that to build something called Cgit. And Cgit is a visualizer for Git repos that I use as a instruction tool. And so if you ever go to github.com/hacked/Cgit, you can try it out. And as you're making commits to a repo, it will move the graph around and show you what's happening kind of behind the scenes. And you realize that like creating a new branch is actually just writing a line in a file. That's why it's so cheap. It's not like copying everything from one directory all the way to another directory, like you might have in other systems. So, as you learn that, you realize that Git is really flexible, really powerful. It gives you all these tools that you can do some really cool things, but you can also, shoot yourself in the foot. But one of the key things to know about Git is that, even when you do shoot yourself in the foot, you almost always never actually lose anything. There's always a way to kind of get back to where you were. But sometimes those things are a little bit arcane, depending on what you've done. And the other thing is that a lot of source control systems, if you make a mistake, you're kind of like, you have to live with that mistake. Whereas Git, a lot of times, allows you to just do a bunch of work and then figure out what the commit history should look like after the fact. Like you can group things into logical commits after the fact and do things like that. And I really like that because a lot of times, the answer to, question, oh, I did this earlier and I want to fix it is, well, you shouldn't have done that. Had time machines and could change history. Right. Well, we wouldn't have done, we probably spent our time doing better things than worrying about our commit history, but that, Git allows you, that's the key, one of the things about Git is it allows you to change your mind after the fact and fix things up.
I do have to tell you that the last guy to tell me that Git was fairly simple was Paul Betts, and he thinks the active extensions are fairly simple. So,
well,
I think one, a few things that have thrown me and maybe other people off on moving to Git. One used to be that the tools were not so good on Windows, and it was difficult to set up and all that. And I think that you and Paul and team have really done a lot of work to solve that problem. The combination of GitHub in general as a website and as services, and then also the GitHub for Windows client, and just in general, Git support and documentation have really come up a ways. And then another thing that's been tricky with Git is that it can be used in a lot of different ways. There are a lot of different flows to it. And so it's kind of more like a construction kit for building your own source control, I've heard people say. And so, again, like tools help with that, or like people documenting their flows and stuff help. But I think that was more, for somebody coming from, TFS or Subversion or even Mercurial, things are generally a little bit more kind of like, well, here's how you do it. Whereas with Git, it's kind of like, depending who you talk to, there's different ways of doing it. I mean, it seems like it's to make this into a question, it seems like some of the work that you've done on GitHub for Windows has been in
making it easy to follow a flow rather than having to figure things out for yourself. Was that pretty intentional?
Yeah, that's a fair like characterization of Git, right? It's a collection of utilities that allows you to do almost anything you want. So what do I do? We're trying to kind of help people into what we call like the GitHub flow. I think there's a blog post by Scott Chacon who talks about GitHub flow, but like doing your features in a branch, submitting a pull request, and then merging that branch to the master. That's, you know, pretty much the high level flow of, you know, how to do feature works. A lot of times, you know, when I introduce Git to people, they say, well, you know, I don't need cheap branches, or I don't need branches. And often what they really mean is branches are so painful in every other source control system I've ever used that I've now, you know, don't want to use them anymore. But when you do it in GitHub, you find that it actually opens up a lot of, it's actually very freeing. So for example, like, you know, today I'm working on three different bug fixes. And so I'm doing each one in a branch, and it allows me to like do a little bit in one and then, you know, push it up for a code review, switch to the other branch. And all of these branches are branched off of like the master, so that when I switch to the next branch, I don't have my half done work from my other branch sort of clouding things. And, you know, and I can do each of these things in isolation, and it allows me to, you know, task switch in a very clean manner. And then as each branch gets done, or even while each branch is in progress, I'll submit a pull request so I can get feedback from people. One of the, you know, things about pull requests is you don't have to wait till your feature's done to issue a pull request. A lot of times a pull request is good to start, you know, after the first commit even, so that people can start a discussion on what you're doing. Yeah, so then, you know, start the pull request, get the discussion going, and then when everything is good, we merge into master. So that's the general flow, and it's a pretty straightforward, simple flow. Some people like to throw in things like rebase. Like sometimes I like to rebase my local commits against, you know, master. And all that really means is if I've been working on a branch locally and I haven't shared it with anyone, and new commits have happened in the master branch, I might want to basically take my commits and instead of merging them with master, put them on the tip of master, kind of like, you can't see me move my hands, but almost like moving my graph of commits to the very tail rather than creating this, you know, branch and merging it in as if I had branched off of the new tip all along. But long story short, like that's not a necessary thing. That's a way some people like to do it because it keeps their history kind of clean. Others just prefer to merge changes in, and you can totally do that as well. If you notice that GitHub, for example, there's a button when you are ready to merge a pull request in, you can click a button on the website and just merge it in. So we always do a merge, and that's sort of the GitHub.com's approach. What you do locally is up to you, but we're trying to help people, you know, follow into a flow. And, you know, people have strong opinions about any given flow. Like GitHub for Windows doesn't have support for rebase in the app. You have to drop to the command line to do it. And that's kind of intentional, as, you know, not that I personally like rebase, but we don't think it's necessarily appropriate to, like, expose every possible feature of Git in the GUI. And I think that will help people sort of fall into a pattern and fall into, you know, being able to use it. And then as they get more and more expert at it, they can always drop into the console and do whatever it is they want to do. And that's one of the things, you know, we're kind of proud about with GitHub for Windows, is that even if you don't care for the GUI because you're a Git guru, we make it really easy to get the command line, the Git command line on your Windows machine and set with appropriate defaults and set with PoshGit, for example. So it makes a really nice experience when using even Git command line.
I think I very much agree with the two things you said at the beginning. So anyone that's listened and been put off by, you know, hearing about, you know, branching and merging, and I was definitely bitten by those early on in my dev career, and it was just so painful where we had dev branches that were sitting out there that, you know, I think the dev team at this financial company, we had to dedicate like weeks for merging. You know, it was just horrible. And so like, it was just something you didn't want to do. It wasn't worth the pain. And now like I have a
a few websites that I work on, and you know, we deploy to Azure websites, and we do that with Git push, and we just have different. We just flop back and forth between different branches all day long, and pushed it to a different branch, which gets picked up by stage or QA or production servers. It's super nice, and merging is nice because of the magicalness of Git. Like it actually works.
It's a lot of back. It says you don't pay for the backup, you pay for the restore. And branching is the same way. But yeah, branching is easy in any system. It's the merging that's the hard part, but getting it easier than other systems.
So if someone is now convinced by what you've said and they're excited about the idea of this, is there a place they can go to get started on learning, first of all, GitHub for Windows, and then as needed, the rest of
Git? Yeah, a couple places. Windows.github.com is a good starting point to get the GitHub for Windows application. And then we have help, I think, .github.com. Yeah, so help.github.com has a lot of good information. Training.github.com. We have a lot of cool resources for learning Git, web-based classes, in-person training, and so on. Sometimes we have some of these guys have office hours online, but we have these amazing trainers. So, like, if you want to learn even more, or have someone come to your office and teach Git, these guys are pretty amazing. They fly like billions of miles every year, and I don't know how they do it. Definitely want to give those guys a shout out. But there's a lot of resources online. What one thing we need to do a better job of is actually build up our documentation on GitHub for Windows itself, like how you integrate that into your workflow. And that's something that we're going to try to do now as well, because a lot of the documentation you find will be specifically looking at the command line. And like, for example, me personally, I use both the command line and the GUI. I like using the GUI for like crafting my commit messages and crafting my commits, because it allows you to pick and choose easily which files you want in a particular commit, things like that. But like when I'm doing something more, you know, exotic, I always drop to the command line, like doing rebasing or interactive rebase.